Welcome to Excess Returns, where we focus on what works over the long term in the markets. Join us as we talk about the strategies and tactics that can help you become a better long-term investor.
Justin Carboneau and Jack Forehand are principals at Validia Capital Management. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Validia Capital. No information on this podcast should be construed as investment advice. Securities discussed in the podcast may be holdings of clients of Validia Capital.
Hey guys, this is Justin. In this episode of Excess Returns, Jack and I talk with Steve Romick, managing partner at FPA, a value investing firm focused on generating strong long-term returns while also preserving capital and managing downside risk. We talk to Steve about FPA's investing process, what they look for in terms of finding good businesses, managing risk, and learning from investing successes and mistakes. This is a good discussion with an investor who has a long-term track record of investing in all different types of markets while maintaining an independent and objective long-term view and perspective. As always, thank you for listening. Please enjoy this discussion with FPA's Steve Romick. Hi, Steve. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
Jack and I are super excited to have you on. I mean, we're going to talk about your investment strategy, the value orientation you have. I think very importantly, how you and your team go about managing risk. I think that's one of the things that really stands out when we look at the fund and your track record is its ability to do really well in tough periods. And I think that's something we'll sort of want to talk to you about and sort of hear your philosophy on that and why that's important for investors to be thinking about. But one of the things that that's pretty cool too is that I don't think we've ever had anyone on the podcast that has a firm with an actual 30-year track record, which is pretty amazing.
Well, you basically just called me old in your intro.
we'll have to edit the intro now.
Well, notice I said firm. I didn't say person, but you're since you're the. But I mean, that is, you know, if you think about that, there's very few, I mean, in the mutual fund world, I don't even know how many funds would be out there with a 30-year. I mean, of course, you have some that have been around for a long period of time. But I mean, 30 years is impressive. And especially when you have a track record like you guys have, which I think is very good. That's just something that stands out. And I know on the firm site, you know, that's something you guys are very proud of as well. So
we are. Thank you for making, you know, you're showing your awareness of it. It's, you know, it feels like while feeling old, that you know. Certainly, it you know, looking back, I say with a certain amount of humble pride that it's nice to, you know, sit here today.
When you think about the career that you've had in building FPA, managing the fund over the long term, what advice would you give to your younger self, do you think? What lessons have you learned that really stand out to you? That you would say, you know what, I kind of wish I knew that when I was maybe starting out earlier in my career.
I wish when I was young that I really appreciated the need to be true to yourself first and let the clients, you know, fall where they may. In my earlier years, I tried to, you know, probably please too many people, and you can't please everybody. You have to invest the way you invest, and you know, and hopefully you find enough like-minded people to come along. And so I think that they're probably had invested a little bit too much time in doing things that were less productive and not in the service of myself and those clients who were like-minded.
Yeah, I could see how that's challenging as a sort of a younger money manager trying to gather assets and grow. You know, you want to try to, I guess, please everyone, but you know, you kind of got to find your focus, find your niche, find your key competency and try to run with that. That's very good.
I think I learned subsequent to that, I mean, as a non-business, it was always try and tie in, you know, things that are happening in our lives and how it impacts your business. I think one of the things that learned me to be more accepting of just who I am and knowing what I'm doing is right is having four daughters, because I rarely get anything right at home. At least I have a shot at the office.
Yeah, I bet. I have two and they're a little bit younger, but I'm getting a lot of stuff wrong as well. So we hide out in our office all day. So one of the things with Crescent is you really are a go anywhere fund. And we're going to talk about sort of some of the unique things that the fund owns in a little bit here. But how do you think that, I guess, investment style affected or how is that either important in such a way that you manage money? And how has that, I guess, changed the way that you operate the fund, knowing that you can go anywhere? I mean, you have this value investing focus, but did it prove challenging ever? Or was it always sort of an asset that you had that you were able to leverage into strong performance?
It proved challenging in my early years from a marketing perspective, because back then in particular, allocators wanted to put investors into a box. And it's hard to box, you know, somebody who goes a lot, who can invest, you know, with the breadth that I've invested with and our team's invested with over the last, you know, 3 decades. So I think that was probably the greatest challenge at the outset. But in terms of how it, you know, how it affects our day-to-day, it gives us greater opportunity to consider, you know, more investment, you know, ideas. If there is something that is attractive, you know, thematically, let's just take, you know, commercial real estate as an example. And there's a lot of bad news, you know, surrounding commercial real estate today. People working from home, there's less of a need for offices and to a certain degree, and certainly different by market. But if we're interested in commercial real estate, then how does one apply the principle of seeking value in the commercial real estate sector? Well, having the breadth that we do, we just can look at more things. So let's just think about it like office buildings. If you wanted to go and buy an office building, you wanted to buy a 3-story building, consider that a small cap, a 20-story building, a mid cap, and a 70-story building, a large cap. The analysis is going to be the same for all three of those buildings. You know, what is the replacement cost? What's the tenant mix? You know, what's the occupancy? What's the current cash flow, expected cash flow, you know, on that business? It's, you know, what's happening in the local economy that could affect things in the future, et cetera, et cetera. And so we can invest in these different caps, and we can do the same analysis for a building here or buildings, you know, in the United Kingdom or some other country. Or for that matter, what if, you know, the equity of that building wasn't as attractive, but the debt was trading at a discount, offering us double-digit yields, hypothetically. And so there's different ways to skin the cat, if you will, and, you know, by being able to have the breadth that we have. We're just not forced into this narrow construct of you got to be a mid-cap investor, and you're an equity investor. You can only look at that 20-story office building.
Yeah, one of the interesting things we were going to ask you about later that relates to that, this idea of you've actually invested directly in cargo ships, I believe, which, you know, you probably won't see too many mutual funds that have invested in cargo ships. I'm wondering, can you just talk a little bit about how that works? I mean, how would you analyze a cargo ship?
Well, it has an asset value, and these assets actually, trade quite liquidly. So there's a real market for them. And so you want to try and buy them at a point in time, you know, you can look at what the market pricing is for these different, you know, ships, you know, different container ships and such. And you can you buy it, you know, when day rates are low. If you have a point of view, the day rates will be higher in the future. That's what we did.
I want to go back to what you said at the beginning when you were talking about one of your lessons is the client will fall where they may, and that's something I struggle a lot with, is this whole idea of behavior. And you know, we're obviously newer investors than you are, so we have to worry about this maybe more than you do. But I struggle with this idea. You know, when we run very focused portfolios, if the investors you get are not on board with the ups and downs that come with focused portfolios, then, you know, those investors are almost better off buying an index fund than investing with us, because their behavior will eventually get the best of them. And I'm just wondering, do you think about that at all when you run your fund? Do you think about like the behavior and can my clients stick with this? Or, you know, you guys have obviously built a really, really long track record, so maybe that's not something you have to worry about as much, you know, as we do.
Well, interestingly, you know, we have a lot of active share in our portfolio. We are certainly sector and geographically agnostic. And so we will lean into where the opportunities are. And that might mean not owning certain sectors as much as it might mean owning, you know, double what an index weight in a certain sector might be. So it certainly creates performance ultimately that could be at points in time vastly different than the market or our peers. That said, the byproduct of our strategy, you know, has actually ended up in a providing a smoother journey for our investors. I don't think there are many funds that probably have a, if you look back on our returns on a rolling five-year basis, we've made money every rolling five-year period since inception. Our journey has been smoother for our investors. Volatility, you know, to your point, behaviorally, is very difficult for a lot of people to handle. And so they end up, you know, buying or selling at the wrong time. So volatility is an institutional measure of risk. I think it's not an accurate, it's certainly not an accurate measure for risk for myself or my partners here on the Contrarian team, Brian Somo and Mark Landecker. You know, volatility creates opportunity. You know, it breeds it. It allows us to buy something in weakness using the container ship, you know, example that we just you know, walk through, as well as gives us the opportunity to sell something when markets get tighter, when day rates are up with respect to the container ships. So that for us is, you know, creates the ability to generate, you know, excess returns, you know, over cycles within our portfolio of invested of risk assets. But that, while that doesn't work for me as a measure of risk, it's probably appropriate, because if volatility precipitates an action because you have a little bit of FOMO and you got to get into something because it's going up, or because you're panicking because it's going down, then you have to really think about that and in allocating your own capital. So for our investors, we've actually been able to provide a smoother journey as a byproduct of what we do. Not that it's not targeted. We don't target low vol. You know, we target to generate an equity rate of return and avoid permanent impairments of capital. And by doing it across the capital structure, investing in small cap, mid cap, large cap stocks, investing in equities and in preferred stock, convertible debt, junior debt, senior debt, bank debt, some private loans, the occasional privates, the occasional derivative, that's just as a byproduct turned into a smoother journey for our investors, which has allowed them on average to stick with us more so than the average fund.
I want to ask you a little bit more about value investing, but first I want to ask you about inflation, because this is, you know, in my career, I've never seen inflation like this. And, you know, I don't think a lot of us, when we saw what happened in 2020, thought inflation was going to come in the way it did, you know, after all the fiscal stimulus. So I'm just wondering, you know, you've had a long career. I'm just wondering, not going back to the old thing again, because we're not going to do that. But I'm just wondering, like, how do you think about what we're seeing right now from inflation and think about it in a historical context?
You know, I think it's a great question. I wish I had a great answer to your great question. I don't think there's a historical context, because we've never actually had rates from the beginning of time going back 1,000 years or as low as these rates got and stayed for an extended period. And I think the kind of euphoria that came from those low rates, it's almost like, you know, spent a lot of time at the spike punch bowl, that was great, and it felt really wonderful for that period of time. I think now we're just beginning to deal with the hangover. So what does that hangover look like in terms of how it's going to affect the economy, how it's going to, you know, what rates will ultimately end up being, which is partly a function of what the powers that be want them to be, at least on a stated basis, as well as, you know, how we're going to, you know, what the level of inflation will be as well. We just don't know the answer, you know, to these questions. Or so how it affects us individually, you know, and collectively is what we're trying to, as we try and work through, as we analyze as individual companies. We don't have a crystal ball, and we don't know what point in time in history that this period of time rhymes with. I mean, history doesn't necessarily repeat itself, as I can't remember who it was that once said that. You know, but it rhymes, and we're looking for that rhyming, and we just don't have a strong point of view as to what that looks like, you know, prospectively.
Yeah, to your point, when we've talked to great investors in the podcast, I think one thing a lot of them have had in common is their willingness to say, I don't know sometimes. I mean, if you think about what just happened, I mean, we've had the pace at which rates increased was, you know, it may not be unprecedented, but it's certainly, you know, an outlier in history. And so I don't know if anybody really knows exactly what's going to happen from here.
Somebody will be on the cover of some magazine in the next year or two that got it right. and then they'll get a lot of, you know, plaudits and then try and get it right again, you know, for the next 10, 20 years. I mean, we've seen that time and time again. Somebody will get it right. It's just not going to be us.
And it just, and they won't get it right the next time, right. For most likely, at
least. We're better at responding to what's handed us. We are very good, I think, historically, at, you know, looking at what the market offers and trying to find, you know, where the opportunity is within that. And we think of ourselves, you know, as in some ways as arbitragers, and not merger arbitragers as most people would first think about it, but really as arbitraging, you know, perception and reality. We establish what we believe the reality is and is likely to be, and then to the great, you know, to the extent that the perception is vastly different than that, creates, you know, a lot of room to operate and creates, you know, hopefully a margin of safety in making a given investment.
Yeah, it made me think about Michael Mobus in there with expectations investing. It seems like you're using a very, you know, similar idea.
I mean, yeah, we think we have our expectations and there's the market expectations. And the wider the gulf between them, the greater the opportunity, the higher the conviction, you know, in our expected outcome, combined with the wider the gap between perception and reality, or our perceived reality, the larger the position for us.
So are you thinking about macro at all when you build a portfolio, or are you just doing a bottom-up analysis where you're looking at individual companies and you're analyzing them? Or are you thinking at a high level, I've got this new headwind of inflation and I have to think about that as I look at these companies from the bottom up?
We look at everything from the bottom up, but in looking at things from the bottom up, one has to look at what one believes one has to have a backdrop. I mean, is our backdrop one of higher rates or lower rates? Or is our backdrop one of a good economy or a bad economy? And we create these in our models, you know, we look at things on a low case, base case, and high case. And the low case may include a recession, but we don't think it's not going to be permanent. So we're looking at value on the base case. Can we make a good IRR in the base case? And then and have optionality on the upside case. And hopefully the low case is something that's ephemeral and just gives us a mark to market while we're waiting for the base case to prove true. And we're constantly going back to look at our arguments, you know, on an ongoing basis to make sure the validity remains.
You mentioned Graham's concept of margin of safety, and we've talked to a lot of the value investors who use that, and they all seem to use it in a little bit of a different way. And I'm just wondering if you could talk about what margin of safety means to you.
Margin of safety to us means making an investment where we believe that the asset or business that we're buying is worth substantively more than what we're paying, such that if we get something a little bit wrong, we're not going to get killed. We're not likely to lose money. We're not likely to lose a lot of money.
And how do you think about value investing? You know, when you think about one of the things a lot of us have struggled with is, especially those of us that run like quantitative, you know, more, you know, quant type strategies, is the Facebooks and the Googles of the world, I know both of which you own, have been like challenging to analyze because of the high levels of intangible assets that they have, and because some of your traditional value approaches may not work as well with them. I'm just wondering, do you change your process at all when you think about them, or is it really the same process just applied to a different type of company?
So I think this really goes to my evolution as a value investor, which I actually just wrote about as a chapter intro for the new 7th edition of Graham and Dodd's Security Analysis that says Seth Klarman edited. And when I look back and I started out as a value investor, I thought about margin of safety. The margin of safety, trying to figure out how it was predicted by that asset or business, was so much of it appeared on balance sheet. I was buying something, you know, below book value maybe, or not much above book value. And I maybe it was a business that had some hidden assets, maybe real estate, you know, that was owned that hadn't been monetized and they could sell that. You know, we try and looked into the balance sheet, what was in and around the balance sheet on and off to find that protection. As I evolved as an investor, I realized that it was much better to, you know, own better businesses over time. And again, a lot of credit goes to my partner, Mark Landecker, to really driving that point home, you know, for me and to my other partner, Brian Selmo. But I mean, look, the early guidance certainly came from Charlie Munger to Warren Buffett, you know, and I was candidly a little bit slow on the uptick. You know, why just buy these businesses or cigar butts to get a couple bucks when you can own something that can keep throwing, you know, paying, you know, grow its cash flow over many years as long as you're paying a reasonable price for it. So as we, so the protection and establishing that margin of safety morphed from the protection of the balance sheet to the protection of the business. So we have to analyze not just what's on balance sheet and off balance sheet. It's what we were doing before, but we're looking at analyzing that business and analyzing what cash flow is likely, you know, to be in, you know, in the coming years. And what multiple we're going to pay for that cash flow, which is, you know, going back to your prior point, you know, partly tied to, you know, what level of what's your discount rate, which is a function of the rate environment. And so, you know, we've morphed from, you know, just I've morphed, you know, specifically from seeking that protection of the balance sheet to getting the protection of the business. And so it's our job to understand what the value of the business is. And it's not that hard. And we're buying Google in 2011 when people were fearful of a weak economy. And the stock had traded down. It is ad-based business, economically sensitive. And once we had made the necessary adjustments to the to its enterprise value, subtracting, from its enterprise value some of these non-earning assets, you know, some of their moonshot investments, as well as adjusting for cash, taking cash off, and as well as adjusting for stock-based comp, putting that, you know, back in as an expense. You know, we found that we're buying a company in the low teens. And for a business with a franchise that Alphabet had and has, it was a pretty attractive risk reward. And we still own it because it's never become too expensive.
Do these type of companies require much more of a deep dive than what you remember, like going back to like more historical types of companies you invested in?
I always invest in businesses like this. Going back to the beginning, it was always something that I did. It's just more of a focus today, you know, by virtue of the fact there's less of the other. So many of the other, the more traditional, you know, value investments were many of these businesses that were just not great businesses and were more likely to be disintermediated, you know, by technological shifts or competitive shifts in the landscape. So we got a lot of things, you know, we tend to get more right than we get wrong, but we certainly get things wrong. And no better example of something that we got halfway right, but not entirely. And that would be when we had a good, clear understanding of Amazon, of what that business was doing, you know, in the digital realm and in online retail, and how it would impact traditional brick and mortar retail, where I had historically had a lot of investments. And we correctly sold all of our brick and mortar retail. We incorrectly failed to buy Amazon. So we got it half right, you know, and the retail that we sold, you know, it underperformed on balance the rest of our portfolio. So that was, you know, a partial win, but a pyrrhic victory, you know, it was, because we did not, you know, really do a deep dive in Amazon and underwrite it in a way that really allowed us to consider it as an investment for the portfolio, really consider, you know, what the AWS side of the business, you know, meant to it and how we could potentially have gotten comfortable in owning Amazon, you know, 15 years ago, when we didn't. And in fact, I mean, I remember reading the Everything Store, and just after I read that, I just felt sick to my stomach. I just I felt like an idiot.
Amazon made me think about the idea of disruption, because we've got another high level of disruption going on right now with a lot of AI type companies. And, you know, it's kind of early in that process, so we don't know how it's going to play out. And if history is any guide, there'll probably be some huge winners and, you know, most of the companies probably won't work out. But how do you think about that as a value investor? I mean, do you look at that at all to try to see if there's any potential opportunities? Do you look at some of the established companies and how they're going to use it? Like, how do you think about AI in general?
Well, first off, we look at every new technology and frame it like, where can we possibly make money from this if we have a point of view that it's going to be a winning technology? And we think about, you know, so it can be a direct investment tied to that. It can be the application of that technology. And it also might mean, you know, or will mean that we are forced to look at how that technology might impact other businesses. And that example of Amazon's, in online retail, you know, and the disruption to brick and mortar is a good example of that. So we spent a lot of time thinking about all three of those. In case of AI, The large language models really is going to be the domain of very, very few companies, companies with extremely large data sets and the processing, the compute power to really work, work the data. It's going to require billions and billions of dollars. So it's very, very few companies that are going to be winners in the large language model, area. Many of them, some companies you've mentioned, we've already, chatted about today. Applied AI, how those companies are going to take AI to use those businesses, use the technology to make their businesses better. And so we think about that and look at different businesses and consider who could win by, through the application of AI. Now, a simple example of that would be something where we certainly are an expert in. But if you think about biotech, the bench strength of labs has gone up exponentially because of AI. We are not biotech experts, but I think it's a. I think it could harbor the new order, and more NMEs, new molecular entities coming to market because of the application of AI. And so, we spent a lot of time thinking about that, and also about what businesses could be disruptive. We spent how disruptive will call centers be? How disrupted will advertising agencies be? So we spend a lot of time debating that and talking to experts in these industries to kind of understand that.
Do you see AI as like maybe one of the major disruptions of our lifetime? I mean, some people are putting it like above the internet and up like an electricity or something in terms of how important it's going to be. I mean, do you see it at that level?
I have no reason not to see it at that level. I don't want to go and position myself as a technologist. I'm just not. But I mean, there are every reason to think that AI, is a well-known person who I'm going to leave nameless, because the anecdote was related to me, said, he positioned this someplace between the harnessing of electricity and the interaction of the internet, and I have no reason to dispute that point of view.
I'm just curious, have you used AI at all in your investment process, like behind the scenes? Do you guys use ChatGPT or anything like that?
No, we haven't. I use Grammarly to help, write my shareholder letters now.
I could probably use Grammarly to write my letters as well, because they could use some improvement. What do you think? You mentioned cigar butts before. What do you think about traditional value investing, buying the cheapest companies? I mean, do you think that type of strategy has had a really, really long period where it didn't work very well? I mean, and a lot of people have been arguing maybe that's the end of the road for that type of strategy. It's not going to work anymore in the new world we live in. I mean, what do you think about this whole idea that value investing might be dead?
The premise of your question, I'm going to push back on. A couple of ways. One, I don't think there's a bright line that divides, value investing. And I don't think that the definition of cheap is that word is, I don't think there's a universal definition of cheap. If you have a company that's trading at 30 times earnings, I think that most people, value investors, traditional values, would say that's not cheap. But if that company, and you had the conviction that business would grow its earnings 50% a year for the next few years, all of a sudden it could look, pretty cheap on that basis. So I think that just as beauty is in the eyes of the beholder, I think that, cheapness and value is in the eyes of the beholder as well. And so for us, the way we think about it, we want to get the best businesses at the best prices is what we look for. And sometimes, those opportunities don't present themselves and cash will build in our portfolio. Other times there's tons of things for us to do that we think offer attractive risk rewards, and we will get more invested as a result.
Yeah, this is a trap those of us that are quantitative value investors fall into a little bit. We see all the academic research, which is like buy the bottom decile of the cheapest companies and short the decile of the most expensive companies, and think that is value investing. But going back to Michael Mauboussin when he was on our podcast, he basically pushed back in the same way you did to this question. He said, value investing is buying a company for less than it's worth, full stop. I still remember that answer because it was kind of the same exact thing you're getting at.
And for us, we want to buy a business that's worth, that is trading for less than the business is valued at today. And that gap, that discount, is going to be a function of what we think its growth rate is going to be over the course of time. So we want to buy businesses with tailwinds. I don't mean they're go-go growth business. I just mean, look, it's really hard to buy a business where the wind's in your face. There's too many things that can go wrong. We like growth in the industry. Ideally, to bail us out. If we don't get it, we're never going to get anything exactly right. We never have. We get things directionally right, on average, but nothing. If we look at our models, no companies in my 3+ decades of investing has ever nailed the number.
A corollary, Larry, to that question that I've kind of struggled with myself is this idea that a lot of people will say in the new world we're living in, fundamentals are mattering less. Things like narrative are driving the market a lot more than fundamentals. And I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on that. I remember David Einhorn was on Patrick O'Shaughnessy's podcast. You may not have listened to this, but he was talking about this a little bit. And he was saying, to some extent, he's given up on the idea that the market's going to revalue companies. And he's trying to focus on companies where, he's getting cash flow or buybacks or something where he knows he's going to get a return, even if the company doesn't revalue the company. I'm just wondering, do you think there's anything to that?
I can't speak to exactly to what other sets. I've heard people say different things, but I can't contextualize it because I don't have those conversations in my head. Although I've listened to some of them, I would say that at the end of the day, there needs to be some kind of catalyst, but that catalyst, if you have a business that is cheap and it's throwing off a ton of cash. And it's not growing a lot, but it's got some growth, but it's throwing off a ton of cash and they're doing the right thing with that cash. Then, as long as you have the staying power, you should make money over time. I say staying power because the narrative can often, trump the fundamentals for extended periods. And we just came through at least the longest period I'd ever seen of that, partly, driven by low rates, largely driven by low rates. Well, driven by a combination of low rates and new technologies that are real technologies.
Yeah, to your point, I think that might be the answer here is that, it's not that fundamentals don't matter. It's that in this world, narrative can detach companies from fundamentals for maybe a longer period of time than occurred in the past. And it can require more patience, if you have a thesis to wait for that thesis to play out.
Correct.
Just a couple more before I hand it back to Justin. I want to ask you a couple of portfolio construction questions. I know you run a pretty focused fund, and I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you think about the idea of portfolio concentration, position sizing, things around those issues.
With respect to the Crescent Fund, our flagship mutual fund, we'd love to get to, 5% positions, but we like to have a portfolio that is, kind of diverse, is somewhat diversified, but not overly diversified. We will be concentrated in certain companies where it could be 3-5% positions. And we also could be concentrated in certain sectors and asset classes. And so, there's no reason why we can't have, at points in time, a concentration in cement companies, which is far in excess of the market, that should offer, GDP-like, GDP plus growth, over time. But I think that it's important when we look at these, whatever it is that we own, we just need to have a conviction that it's something that should perform well, over the next, 3-5 years, in recognizing that in the interim, it could, might have a period of underperformance. We could have a bad economy. We could have, a pandemic or whatever the case may be. We looked really, really stupid, in our portfolio, at the beginning of COVID was not a portfolio that was built for COVID. We were negatively impacted by COVID. So we had more of a drawdown on our fund than we had historically, had occur in other points in time. Now, and then we started leaning into companies that were good businesses, but earlier days of COVID, that looked cheap at one price and then they dropped another, 20-30%. So they just got cheaper and we looked stupid. We ultimately ended up being proven correct. And we had that ability to stick around and get over, look to the and get to the other side. And that's really how we think about this all the time is, do we have the staying power, to get to the other side? Do we have the staying power to have a concentration in a certain, company or industry and such that it might be outside relative to the market, but what happens if we invert the thesis and maybe we get it wrong? What could happen to these names? As a result, and how might that impact the portfolio? So we're constantly taking whatever favorable thesis we have, and we're trying to invert it and look at it from the negative, and show you which we think is helpful, you know, to put on that black hat to protect capital in those, you know, these various points in time where things work against you. So there's not, I'm not giving you a scientific answer. It's as much art as it is, you know, as it is applying some modeling to it and saying what could happen in these different scenarios, you know, but it's not that precise. And you could have a very focused portfolio, a very concentrated portfolio, as opposed to the, you know, the way you describe this as focused. I think we're focused, but without being, terribly concentrated. And it's nice to have some level of diversity because you will at points in time get things wrong.
You mentioned COVID, and I'm just curious, if you take yourself back to that period, like, what were you thinking? You know, all of us have really never seen anything like this. You know, we're thinking the economy shut down. We don't know what's going to happen. Like, as somebody managing a portfolio during this, how are you thinking about this? I mean, you know, you've got good businesses, but you've also, you know, you've got this weird outlier event that we may never have seen before that affects the economy. Like, how are you thinking through that?
Well, I mean, it's a question that needs to be answered, I think, in two parts. One is from an investment perspective, and the other is from an existential perspective, because we are facing, you know, all of us, you know, who invest money, you know, professionally or just for our own portfolios, this idea of our portfolio going down in value and having, you know, was viewed by some as like, you know, well, certainly there's an impairment. How deep was that impairment going to get? How long was that going to last before you came out the other side? At the same time, they were worried for our lives or the lives of those of our loved ones, you know, family and friends. And trying to do that in concert was, you know, was not always so easy to separate. A lot of emotion gets imbued. So what we forced ourselves to do was take a step away from the pandemic and the emotion of it and said, are people still going to go and stay in a hotel? Yeah, at some point, they're going to go back to a hotel. Let's buy Marriott, a more asset light model with a great global brand. And that was an example of a company that we bought after it came down significantly and kept going down. And we ended up, being proven correct, but we didn't look so correct for a period of time. And so it's really important to separate the emotion and think about where the world might be. Think about the analogs. Now we are aware that, I mean, people call, you know, COVID a black swan event, and I push back every time I hear it, because black swan event by definition is something that is wholly unexpected. I mean, we've had pandemics before. We knew that we'd have them again. As recently as 2015, Bill Gates had a wonderful TED Talk discussing pandemics, and how we were woefully unprepared. And so then when it came, we weren't horribly surprised. It was I wrote a white paper a long time ago. Maybe it was part of a shareholder letter, talked about, we work hard not to be surprised. And, we want to anticipate. And so we weren't surprised by it. But so how does one then respond to it? We looked at it holistically and said, okay, look what South Korea is doing. We think we can get to a similar place and manage this, manage through this fairly efficiently. It's going to be painful. And people are going to lose their lives. Businesses are going to be hurt, but the businesses are going to come out the other side. It got deeper and worse than it had to be because the response to the U.S. was terrible. And that we didn't expect. I mean, and it was, the reaction to it was worse than we thought. And the reaction and the government response was not as robust as we would have hoped. And so when everybody saw that happening, when the government wasn't doing well, I think that kind of fueled, further fear. But at the end of the day, when we sat back and tried to look at it rationally and said, what will the world look like in a couple of years? I think we were, pretty good in that regard. Looking to the other side across those chasms is really, really helpful, and not, getting that sinking feeling in your stomach as you're falling weightlessly into the chasm, but knowing that there's another side. The more you've seen the ups and the downs and the ups, the more you've seen it, the greater the comfort you have. At least I've come down, over time, that I've been there, done that. Now, I've been there and done, different things, but I try and look again for that Ryman.
And to your point, I mean, I think I learned a lot as an investor during that, just because you have to go through these things, you know, to your, you know, you've had a longer career than me. You've been able to go through these things. Like, you know, I was probably more panicked than you were. I mean, obviously we were all panicked about our families and, you know, but in terms of the investing, you know, this is something I think that really separates out the great investors, is the ability to see out in a couple of years in advance when something that stressful is going on and realize everything's going to be okay. And there's going to be opportunities in that.
Yeah, no, agreed. Time is your friend. If you allow yourself to learn from time and allow yourself to make mistakes, learn from your mistakes and move forward. I mean, I think that, you know, what's terribly important, and I don't think I had to tell my younger self this because I've kind of always operated this way, but I think continuous learning is mandatory.
Steve, I wanted to use sort of some of the things that stood out to me with the fund as sort of the, I guess, foundation for the next few questions. And the first thing is the fund has very low turnover. It has like 20% turnover based on the fact sheet that I was looking at. So what goes in, can you just kind of explain your, I think we know what the buy strategy is, but is the sell strategy those scenario sort of planning and looking at, I guess, then what could go wrong and then the likelihood of that going wrong? And then that's how you guys determine what stocks in the portfolio might be sell candidates, or how does that work?
Well, no, because on the front end, we're always looking at what can go wrong. And then we keep updating what can go wrong. You know, what drives the sale is if we see something that if the probability changes in terms of what could happen, we think is more likely to happen, that could, mm-hmm. Create a sale candidate. But hopefully the bigger reason for the sale is that they, you know, thing or is a happy outcome that, you know, somebody out there is happy to bid that security up to a price that doesn't offer an attractive risk reward. So we can find a place to, we take the capital out and redeploy it someplace else.
Okay. And are these decisions being made like at a committee level? I mean, are you guys having like committee meetings and then ultimately these ideas get kicked around and then there's like, how does that work from a decision-making standpoint?
You know, but there's somebody who's point on the various names, the individual names in our portfolio, you know, Brian Selmo for this cohort, Mark for another cohort, and myself candidly today for a smaller cohort, within the portfolio. And we take that responsibility upon ourselves, but there's, you know, often, you know, there's frequent back and forth between some combination of the three of us. But it's not the three of us sitting in a committee. It's not a portfolio driven by committee, but it is three co-portfolio managers who come together in on various levels, you know, depending upon the name or the sector, asset class, et cetera, that, you know, and we have conversations around them.
One of the things that I noticed with the fund is that you have U.S. stock exposure and, you know, kind of a healthy, I guess, mix of international stocks sort of in there and some of the equity positions. And sort of how do you, what's your just general take? Like right now, like if you look at valuations, you know, U.S. versus international, I know you guys are more bottom up with your stock selection, but, you know, generally speaking, how are you looking at international opportunities? And I guess, where do you go to the direct markets and buy those stocks? Or are you limited to ADRs? Or how does that international universe sort of tend to look for you?
Well, I'll answer the second question first. We can trade, you know, securities on the most local exchanges. So we go direct, largely. We do buy ADRs on occasion as well. We can do both, but we have the ability to go direct when we want to go direct for the most part, not in every case. Some countries are, you know, we've not that approval, but those are fewer and far between. The with respect to the valuation differential that one sees today between domestic, you know, U.S. companies and foreign companies, I would start with our framing generally is not where a company is domiciled. It is where the company does business. When there's companies based in the UK, they've got less than 10% of their business in the UK and 40% of their business in the US. There's companies based in the US, you know, that might have, half their sales in the US, but that means another half of their sale, the other half of their sales are coming from someplace else. So I think that we start with where the company is selling to, and where they're domiciled becomes more important from a governance perspective. And you know, it makes a difference if a company is, say, based in Russia versus is selling to Russia. If things go south in Russia, if there's you know, what a country and a government can do to a company that's based there is different than what it can do to a company that's just selling to, you know, to that country. So a lot of companies had to write off some of their businesses, in Russia, you know, recently, in the recent couple of years, you know, and and other companies, other people have had investments in Russian companies that have had to write off the whole thing, close to just part of it, even if some of those companies had businesses, you know, sales outside. So we do make that distinction as well. And I think it's also important to know that when we talk about valuation, and you're talking about it from a quant perspective, and yeah, I think that today international foreign companies trade less expensive than U.S. companies, but they're not out. What we try and do is we look company to company, you know, industry to industry, and look for the similarities. And if it's a, you know, looking to compare an Adidas to a Nike, and how are they valued, and how their prospects might differ. But you can't, you know, you can't compare a Google to anything in Europe, for example, right? So U.S. has more winner take all and winner take most businesses, and than say Europe, for example, and then therefore those companies in the U.S. should trade at higher valuations. You know, if you're a winner take all business or winner take most business with good, you know, growth prospects, should trade at a higher multiple than a company that has not winner take all, winner take most, that has, you know, whose growth prospects are not as strong. And so we have more of those in the U.S. than just say, I'm comparing U.S. to Europe just for the sake of this comparison. And also Europe, in that comparison, has more in financials and banks than we have, and make a larger component of their index. So we're comparing, when we look at multiples, so they've got fewer winner take all, winner take most businesses. We have more, so that should create a higher multiple in U.S. companies versus, you know, versus say European companies. We have less in financials, which on average should have, you know, have lower multiples than they have, as, you know, they have had in this percentage of their indices. But more important than that even is just the fact that I think that our financials, our banks are on average better than the banks, you know, across Europe. There's still a lot of banks that really have not even dealt with the great financial crisis and fully resolved, you know, their balance sheet issues. There's an old accounting term: the left side isn't right, and the right side doesn't have much left. And I can speak to a number of banks in Europe that look like that. They have crappy assets with not enough equity to support those crappy assets. Yet they're on life support. They're zombie companies, effectively, sometimes with government support.
But I think your point is a very good one. You know, we give these broad brush strokes of valuation of different markets or industries or sectors, but you know, your point of like looking under the hood and actually understanding the different characteristics of the companies is, you know, very important for investors to do. And I think that's a great point of U.S. versus international. So thank you for that. The other thing that I wanted to ask you about, so it looks like historically the fund has always had some amount of cash in the portfolio. And it right now, based on the latest numbers that I was looking at, it looks like roughly something like 27% in cash in the portfolio. Is that a function of, and maybe a couple of things, is it a function of like you can't find interesting, good opportunities? Is it a function of having optionality when maybe things go down to pick up the stocks that you want to buy more cheaply? Like, how do you view this cash position in the portfolio? And then I want to piggyback on that, and you can answer it all in one shot, is the sort of drawdown, I guess, characteristics of the fund, which is really, you know, you tend to do better in down markets. Do you attribute a lot of that to the cash position, or is that cash plus your holdings? I'm just wondering, like, how much credit you would give sort of having cash in the portfolio in those down markets as to helping control, I guess, the drawdown periods?
First off, cash is a byproduct of our investment process, period. If we find terrific risk rewards where the cash gets pulled down, we've been in the single digits before in cash. So it's really a function of opportunity, risk reward. And the more attractive the opportunities, the more invested we are, the less attractive the opportunities, the less invested we are. In terms of what it means in terms of our drawdown, it's inarguable that cash has had a big impact. Now, there's been points in time where our stocks have outperformed on the downside and in down markets. And, cash has just been, holding cash has just further improved, the investor experience from a drawdown perspective. But there's been other points in time where our drawdown has been worse than the market for our invested portfolio. I mean, go back to the Great Financial Crisis. I don't remember what our securities did exactly off the top of my head, but we underperformed, the market on our long book, but we were so disinvested, relatively speaking, that we, we looked very good by comparison. And as important is not just did we do better in the downturn, but we really showed our mettle in coming out the other side. So we really think about a lot of these times about stapling these bad years follow, and then to the good year that follows, assuming a good year follows. So 2008 and 9, we actually made money, in that period. Looking at going through the 2021 through today, the market's obviously up today. It was down a lot last year. We're actually, in the plus column, we're stapling those periods together. So we think a lot about that, not just the drawdown, but also coming up the other side. Because being a value investor, keep talking about margin of safety. That's come up a number of occasions, in our short time together. But we don't want to forget about making money on the other side, and that's really important. And making money on the other side is going to come with some additional volatility at points in time, and particularly for people like us who really seek that active share. We're not looking just to beat the market.
Well, I'm curious, what is the one investment that stands out in your mind, head and shoulders, throughout your career? Is there a particular company or a stock that, good or bad? I mean, it doesn't, hopefully it's good, but I'm curious, and what were the qualities or characteristics now for you that if you can identify, how you'd answer that company had that really stood out to you?
We're always looking for inefficiencies, and managing more money, it's harder. I'm going to start with the negative. The one name that always jumps out to me is a negative, and that's a company, a Hong Kong-based holding company called Semitech Global that owned a number of different consumer electronic names, within their portfolio. And we bought that company not below book value, not below working capital, below net working capital. And I still lost money. So I just did not place as much weight on management's doing the right thing at that point in time in my career, as back in the 90s. And I'm stunned that I lost money. But as a math problem, it looked so attractive, I felt I had to own it. And the problem was I just didn't, math problems are, you can look at things very, very clinically, but trying to understand kind of the have a better holistic understanding of management and what they might do that could either improve or harm the business becomes incredibly, incredibly important. In other businesses that stood out, to me, were businesses where there were inefficiencies, there was natural sellers there, and people didn't really understand the opportunity. And, I used to own a lot of these, PS business parks, these different public companies that were small little companies that owned new storage centers on these properties. And there were these different partnerships that Wayne Hughes, who was the who since passed away, I think last year, Wayne, or maybe it was earlier this year, Wayne Hughes, who founded you know, Public Storage had built these up in these syndicates, and they took these syndicates and rolled them into public companies. And they, these, all these little things traded, just bought, you know, these things and owned them as a basket. And then the larger, the mothership, Public Storage started buying them up. And it was just an illiquid, misunderstood, little businesses. And so we just don't, a bunch of those. And there's been other examples like that over time. The best investments are those that, again, the perception reality, gap is really, really wide. I mean, I don't even think there was a perception. I think it was just a lack of interest. And that doesn't happen very often. And I think it happens far less today than it did then with the, with the advent of the internet, with the advent of different, services that communicate, good ideas, and they communicate them broadly to these different, resources, which are incredibly attractive. But, I think that's a lot harder to do, today, to find, it's easy to find, you can find the unloved, it's harder to find the unfollowed.
You had mentioned continuous learning a bit earlier, and I'm just curious, is there any letters, communications, or memos that you don't miss from professional investors or others?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think probably the one thing I really try and make sure I read every week is, 13D research is what I learned this week. I like that. It's thoughtful. They do a good job of considering what the future might hold. I think they're more forward looking than average, and then thoughtfully so.
We have a standard closing question we like to ask all of our guests, which is, based on your experience in the markets, if you could teach one lesson to the average investor, what would that be?
I would say, in addition to continuous learning, which I said at the outset, I would say be flexible. Don't be dogmatic. Be flexible. And just don't assume that your point of view is the right point of view. Always look for reasons why it might not be.
Thank you very much, Steve. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
This is Justin again. Thanks so much for tuning into this episode of Excess Returns. You can follow Jack on Twitter at @practicalquant and follow me on Twitter at @JJCarboneau. If you found this discussion interesting and valuable, please subscribe in either iTunes or on YouTube, or leave a review or a comment. We appreciate it.
Justin Carboneau and Jack Forehand are principals at Validia Capital Management. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Validia Capital. No information on this podcast should be construed as investment advice. Securities discussed in the podcast may be holdings of clients of Validia Capital.